Welcome back to the Learning Code, Andrew, and our audience. We might begin with some introductions for those who don't know too much about you, Andrew. So why don't you
Sure,
go
yeah.
ahead and share what you'd like to share?
So my name's Andrew. I'm currently a sophomore in college, and I met Henry after my junior year of high school. We were taking a summer electricity and magnetism course together. And so we early on formed a study group, and obviously we tried to study that material at hand, but also we learned a lot about each other and began to reflect upon each other's different habits, not only academically, but also just in life. And I think it was a very mutually beneficial summer for both of us. And yeah, I mean, it's been amazing to see this blossom, this Learning Code project blossom from here, because I still remember talking to Henry about a lot of the barriers and the issues that we had noticed in the current educational system, and how we could, as individuals, try to make positive ripples locally, and how those could maybe propagate if more people would espouse those practices. So it's really been amazing to hear where some of those conversations have ended up a few years down the road. So yeah, really honored to be a continued part of this and get to kind of take a peek behind the scenes.
When I reflect on our origin with our, I guess, relationship, the class we were taking, Physics 4B, that was my second time taking that class. And, every time I think about you in the context of my academic journey, I realize that I might not be at San Jose State studying CS had it not been that you were, so willing to tutor me and help me understand those concepts. That was a fundamental course that I needed to do well, semi well in, to meet the requirements to be able to, be a CS student at San Jose State. So I'm just so fortunate and blessed every single time I, get to continue learning from you, continue hearing from you, because you have been part and parcel towards my academic pursuits. So I appreciate you for that, Andrew.
Thank you. Yeah, that really does mean a lot.
And to be honest, we've had many conversations on what learning means and what learning can be that hasn't been documented. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on as a guest here is just to document a bit about our dialogue around these topics that often don't get it's the attention that I think it deserves, because what is the purpose besides learning when it comes to education, right? Credentials for sure, qualifications for sure, but that really enrichment, maybe pursuit requires that we are cognizant about what learning means. So thank you for joining us. And
Yeah, of
the
course. My
first
pleasure.
thing I think might be interesting for our audience to hear is to share about all the work that went into that album that I saw you publish.
Definitely. So, I guess to slightly keep this tied to my academic arc, I'm majoring in mechanical engineering with a minor in music production. I've been writing music since probably elementary school, and it's something that's really become a very fundamental part of my life. And songwriting specifically, music with words and lyrics, is maybe a slightly more recent shift for me. And by that I mean, the past handful of years. And one of my dear friends, Zach, is a music production major at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, which is near my school. And we met in high school, and both ended up in the same area for college. And so he, right after the lockdown had started and we were both back at home, he said, "Hey, we're not really doing anything because the world has kind of come to a standstill right now. Do you want to try to release an album this summer?" And I thought, well, definitely, yeah. And I had sort of a handful of songs that I'd written. I think the earliest one on the album was written in maybe 2016. And I just kind of collected them over the years of different times in my life where I was confronted with some sort of emotion that I couldn't really express any other way but through music. And so each of them were very important to me, but they weren't quite enough to make an album. And so I had to draw on more recent experiences and write a few more. And we ended up with 13 songs, which was just as much work as it sounds like, because we produced, recorded everything in-house, brought in a couple other musicians for a few things where I didn't want to butcher the parts myself. I'd rather defer to somebody who's more knowledgeable in their area. So like, I'm not going to write a better banjo part than a banjo player will play. So I would just let them sort of take some artistic liberties. But yeah, it was this amazing thing to bring together, and by the time the release date rolled around in August, it was just such a surreal feeling to think that a couple months ago it was just an idea. And it was also really amazing because I actually haven't gotten to take very many music production. I haven't taken any music production courses yet in the first, well, will be the first 2 years of college. The options are fairly limited, and the minor is only about five classes. So I think for me, this was not only an amazing personal and I guess almost spiritual experience to kind of get in touch with these emotions and experiences that I'd had for so many years and turn them into this tangible thing. But also it was an amazing supplement for my academics because I'm sort of mooching off of Zach's Berkeley degree, and I think that getting that experience firsthand of far more than anyone would have time to cover in a single semester, I think was amazing for me because, you know, even the best production class just doesn't have the infrastructure to get everyone to produce an album during the semester. It's just not really feasible. We had to bring in so many other musicians, and you know, it was so many hours of work. There's no way that would have been able to be done if it weren't for these circumstances and the fact that we had the whole summer. So in that sense, it was far more valuable than any single class could be, and I think that's on brand for me insofar as I've tried never to rely on just classes alone. I think that if you're passionate about something, it's sort of your obligation to go the extra mile and do some digging outside of what you hear from your instructors. And so again, even though I haven't taken a production class specifically, this is definitely an example where I could have said, oh, you know, I don't really think I'm ready for this. I haven't really had any formal training or instruction. Or I could do what I did and recognize that this was an opportunity that school would not have given me, and it's something that I had to go and seek on my own. And that's something that ever since I was a kid, I was, you know, if there was something that I was really interested in, I would dive really deep, and I would never take the word of my teachers as the end all be all. I would always try to go beyond and see what else I could uncover about it. So yeah, I guess that's sort of my brief synopsis. You know, there were lots of finer puzzle pieces that had to fit together, but in general, yeah, it was a really great nexus between my creative pursuits and my academic ones, I would say.
Yeah, gosh, I have so much to say on that. Three big themes that come to mind is this idea of project-based learning, this idea of collaboration, right? When, I mean, producing those 13 songs, imagine. I mean, I think you could do 13 songs by yourself for sure, but as far as the overall experience and the outcomes, the outreach, it would never even reach the marks that I think it is reaching because you collaborated with others. And the third theme is just how there were many, many moments when you're reflecting on that where I feel like we as students, when we're in classes or we're in traditional lecture or understanding something from a textbook, that we could really try to channel, right? Like we can cultivate this intuitive curiosity or this maybe strategic curiosity amongst these topics. And I definitely remember you doing that. And when we took Physics 4B, that electromagnetism course together, because you would be asking me and yourself, like, questions that are outside the box, right? Questions that Bobby did not ask us. And you would actually, you know, dig a little deeper. And I think because you did that, it made me see these concepts in ways that, you know, Bobby didn't present. It made me see these concepts that the textbook didn't present. And from that standpoint, I feel like you are actually like publishing something when you're dialoguing with your fellow peers on your perspectives with these sometimes very theoretical, too oftentimes too theoretical, too abstract, and too complex. You are publishing a like vocabulary and language and words that in turn form sentences that resonate way more than what our professors or what our textbooks can do. So first and foremost, thank you for that. That I think that is for sure a sign of leadership when you're willing to do that, right? And then yeah, I guess on the project-based learning, like I was thinking to myself, especially this last, you know, virtual semester, like, what is a lecture besides a project dumped onto you, right? Like, you have to decode that stuff. It's so much. You know, my meeting yesterday, I was reflecting that, like, if I were to really track all the questions that immediately arise in my head in a live lecture, I'm trying to develop that habit but it's a really, really painful one to swallow, pick up, because if I'm honest with myself, I'll have like anywhere from 50 to 100 questions at the end of lecture, right? And then it's like, where do you begin, especially with these STEM concepts? So, thank you for that. I did want to ask you a follow-up question, actually.
Yeah, for sure. I have some responses for some of those ideas too.
Oh,
So
please,
it's good, yeah.
please, you're welcome to respond to that, and then we'll see.
So I was, I guess, kind of working from the end slash middle backwards to talking about cultivating curiosity. I think that is, if I had to pick a two-word slogan for my life, that would be a high contender for sure. And it really is something that, I guess you were talking at the end about having to decode lectures. I've had some experiences with professors and teachers in high school who really don't do a great job, in my opinion, making the ideas very clear. There's an Einstein quote that really resonates with me, which is like, if you can't explain it to a 6-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. And I don't mean to at all to condescend and say that I'm like trying to talk to my peers as if they're children. That's not at all what I mean. But this idea of being able to take the very complex and make it very clear, not necessarily simple, because it's oftentimes not, but to make it clear, I think is a very valuable thing to do. And you sort of touched on my doing that in Physics 4B, and frankly, I'd had practice the previous semester because my mechanics physics class in high school was very difficult to follow. And I ended up not only having to learn a lot of it for myself, but also I ended up explaining it to a lot of friends in the class who really weren't understanding what the professor was saying. And I sort of have, over the years of just doing that, like if there's something that I'm doing fairly well in, I try to use that to the advantage of others. I try not to keep it all to myself. And so I think I've had a lot of different experiences doing similar things where I might, if the lecture is not making sense to somebody, then having me regurgitate it isn't going to help. I have to come up with some other idea, some other way to make it clear. So, for example, this past semester, I was tutoring one of my former freshman housemates in a physics class, and I was trying to come up with a good way to make like an intuitive understanding for it. We're looking at like how wheels roll, like what role friction plays in like a rolling wheel, and we were trying to determine if the friction is doing any work to make the wheel move, knowing that work is force times distance in the direction of that applied force. And I was trying to think of an intuitive way to explain that, and I was trying to get him to understand that when a wheel rolls, the point of contact moves vertically, which is really not intuitive because when you see it macroscopically, you see the wheel moving to the side, and you would assume that it must be doing that everywhere. But because it's not slipping, it can be shown that immediately around the point of contact, it moves straight down onto the ground and then straight up again. And I was trying to figure out a good way to make that clear because, again, it's sometimes tough to visualize that sort of thing. And I saw like a bendy ruler lying on my desk, and I'm like, oh, I've got it. And so I said, okay, let's say we zoom really close in on the wheel and it almost looks flat. It just has a little bit of a curve. And now let's say this point is about to hit the ground. And so I just went like that and rolled it a tiny bit. And I said, how did that point move? And then he's like, oh, it just moved down on the table and back up again. And so it's like, that's the sort of thing that his professor didn't show them in class. And it's the sort of thing that is all too easy to just say and kind of assume that everyone's on the same page and then not explain it in more depth. And I don't mean to toot my own horn or anything. I'm just trying to speak on that process of like not stopping at what the professor says, always trying to come up with new ways to understand it, not only for your own sake, but potentially for the sake of other students, like we were talking about in that physics class, asking those questions and probing ideas that maybe Bobby didn't have time for, didn't want to address, didn't think it would be constructive. I think it's always hard for professors that are so experienced and so effortlessly good at solving those problems. I think it can be really hard to translate that to complete beginners that have never seen the material before. And so that rolling wheel example, any career physics professor wouldn't even need to think about that. They're like, yeah, it's rolling without slipping, it moves vertically. But that's kind of a subtle nuance that is maybe not immediately obvious to people if they're learning it for the first time. And so when I was realizing that he was struggling to understand that, I was trying to think of like, okay, the professor probably didn't say this because that's probably not a normal thing to include in a physics lecture. But if it helps, if like every time you think of a rolling wheel now, if he thinks of that ruler like moving just a little bit on the table, that, he's probably never going to forget that because that's such a visceral visual way to understand it. So yeah, I mean, I guess to try to loop that all the way back, like this cultivating curiosity. I try to stay curious beyond the lecture, and think of, if there's something that the like paying attention just as much to what the professor doesn't say as what they do say, because there's only so much they can fit into this 45-minute or 75-minute package or however long the class is, and they're going to take what they think is the best way to explain something, and it might work great for a lot of people. It might not work at all for other people. And I think if I feel that I have multiple ways to understand something and I see that someone is struggling, I'm always eager to try to sort of use my curiosity as fuel for them and see if I can maybe ask questions or go beyond the lecture in ways that might help something click.
Yeah, wow. The main thing that was really popping into my head when you're presenting that, Andrew, is just how important it is to be willing to teach and willing to share. Like, imagine a world where more people knew physics and math or computer science or, I don't know, the basics to nursing or becoming a doctor. Like, imagine a world, right? Like, imagine a world where in developing countries, in their local communities, you had people who knew how to solve some really demanding problems with skills that oftentimes require a backing in some of these STEM concepts, right? Whether it's getting clean water, whether it's building a bridge, whether it's, I don't know, designing a toilet, whatever it may be. Like, imagine a world where we have more people who have these, who can learn these skills and be willing to teach these skills, right? Because ultimately, expert blind spot is a real thing. But another real thing is the price tag of universities and the privileges it requires for people to, be in university. But as we know, like, just because we get a degree, it doesn't mean we're actually going to be doing society any good. I mean, I think fundamentally it's good that, you can become self-reliant and independent and start a family. I think first and foremost, like, cover your butt, right? Like that for sure should be a primary goal of getting a degree and making dough. But I also think, like, if more people, as they navigate the system, right, as they go through high school or college, can document what they do to learn and ways that they see learning objectives or ways that they create their own learning objectives in the actual courses they have to take or in the SAT, ACT prep or whatever it may be in the personal statement process, like drafting that process. It can help a lot of people who don't have the ins to those things, who have no idea what it's like. Like, what is an SAT, ACT? Like, that requires someone to actually explain to them what is that, right? Or what is writing a personal statement? Or why might learning physics be beneficial, not just for more prospects in the Bay Area, but to be able to solve problems that exist in every single community, right? Why might learning econ be more valuable? So that was, yeah, the willingness. I mean, a goal that the Learning Code has been talking about is how to empower students like yourself, students who are who go above and beyond already, right, in terms of like really learning for themselves, but to document, to become content creators in a sense. And I'm not talking about like vlogging how you brush your teeth and how you wipe your butt. I'm talking about like exactly what you're explaining, like that concept you're describing in that physics class, right? I was thinking about the Green's theorem when that was happening, because I remember Jeff had this lecture where he brought in props, because in the Green's theorem it's like rotating, right? And you have to basically, you have to look at the tangential lines and the orthogonal lines, and you freeze, you basically freeze frame it. You zoom in so much that you understand the rotations. And to be honest, if you understand the underlying principles of Green's theorem, you can work up from there, right? Then you can get to the higher theorems. But yeah, like ultimately, professors have a ton of constraints when they have over 20 students in their class. Like, how are they going to meet every single student's learning needs, right? And if they
Well,
have
and
to.
if every student has 50 to 100 questions, like you mentioned, I mean, there's not enough time in the day to get to all of that. So it's a lot, in a lot of cases, up to the students to figure that out. And that also comes back to a lot of the collaboration that you mentioned before as one of the responses, like not just being willing to teach, but also being willing to really work together, which historically I would say is probably one of my weaker areas, actually. I think that I was often in the position in middle school and high school where I would sort of take charge in like group projects. And I think for many years I chalked it up to other people in the group not being willing to put in the work. And I'm now realizing, retroactively that it was probably maybe a combination of some of that, but I think also a lot of it is they're seeing somebody taking, grabbing the horns, so to speak, and just kind of backing off and letting them do that. So I sort of realized that, like, if somebody's doing all the work in a group project, that's at least partially their own fault in a way, if that makes sense. Like, if they're projecting this, like, oh, I don't trust anyone else to do anything, let me just do it all, people will respond to that and say, fine, if you don't want me to contribute, then I won't do it. And that's been something that I've really actively tried to remedy in myself as I've thought about this more introspectively, that I don't want to project this idea that I don't trust the work of others, because I think I was inadvertently making it seem that way when I sort of wanted everything to be perfect, like in middle school and high school and group work. I would think, oh, well, if it's inconvenient, I'll just do that. Oh, I'll just do that too. It's fine. I got it. And I've really tried to let go of that mentality because it's certainly not something that I want to carry with me into the workforce, out into the world. I think it's good that I've caught myself when I have. And in the context of the album, that was another thing that you brought up. Like you said, maybe I could have made 13 songs by myself, but collaboration makes that much stronger. And yeah, I mean, Zach is so knowledgeable about production. Like I mixed a couple of the songs myself. So after everything was recorded, everything has to be balanced, and you sort of clean up the audio and do different things to turn it from just like raw sound files into an actual song. And he's really, really good at that. And I have very little experience doing that properly. And so I mixed, I think, three of the tunes, because he wanted me to have that experience. And I'm sure he could have done it faster than he taught me, and I did it because I was asking him so many questions and he was holding my hand the whole way. But it's really he was absolutely modeling that philosophy of just letting go a little bit and trusting that someone else will do something. Obviously, he was giving me lots of guidance because he's the expert, but he wasn't overly controlling either. He wouldn't say like, oh, I'll just fix that for you. It was always like, no, like you can do this. I trust you to do this. And that was so huge for me to kind of see him in that position. And it's definitely something that I try to do as much as possible now. And I had the chance to do that on the album too, where I would give things to other musicians. I didn't try to be overly controlling or overbearing on what they played because I trusted their musicianship and their own expertise on their instrument more than I trusted myself to write something better. I wanted to give them that freedom because I knew that it would be stronger if I just let them explore and let them find that for themselves rather than trying to tell them what to do. And so I think kind of connecting that back to group work, and I guess this also sort of connects to project-based learning because there a lot of projects are group activities. And I think that it can have a damaging effect to be too much of a quote-unquote leader, to be too controlling, to call too many of the shots. You can very easily, without even realizing it, suppress the creativity of the group. And rather than having something that's more than the sum of its parts, you might just have something that's mostly you with a few contributions that are only there because you allowed them, which certainly loses a lot of the beauty of working together. So again, that's something that I kind of recognize in myself that I would gravitate towards that tendency in high school. And I'm thinking, oh man, like I don't want to do that anymore. Now that I'm kind of cognizant of that effect that I was having without even trying, it's something that I realized like that's not the point of working with other people. Like there shouldn't be a dictator and three people, working together. There can maybe be somebody who coordinates a little bit and sort of leads insofar as they keep everyone together. But I think one of the other quintessential roles of a leader is bringing out the best in everyone rather than directing everybody to do something and kind of controlling the final product single-handedly, which again just misses a lot of the beauty of the collaboration.
I agree. I recognize collaborating and acting as a collaborator requires skills, mindsets, and perspectives that sort of need to be developed, right? Because ultimately, we've all had less than fun experiences in groups when we're either on one end or the other, right? But I appreciate you for sharing that. I think personally, when I'm either tutoring or giving a workshop or maybe even giving a small presentation, I always look for ways to try to facilitate some discussion, aka collaboration, because I recognize I am not the authority. And just because I am standing behind a podium or have the microphone, like ultimately what happens in the brains and the feelings of my audience matters the most. So if they're not engaged and I am not, relating to those two things, like what can they get out of this time that we have together, then what the heck am I doing? It's better if I just shut up and just let them think for themselves and pose a good question, right? So I love the idea of collaboration. I know Jeff, this next virtual quarter is going to work on trying some small group facilitation in his classes. I also know that there's a reason why he's trying it now versus, maybe his first year of teaching, because it is important to get people more on board. It requires a launch, right? Imagine, like, if we're going to collaborate on Green's theorem, right? It requires people to have common language on Green's theorem. And that's one of the challenges in STEM, because that language is not, it's very far from intuitive, and it requires prep, it requires preview. Otherwise, you'll just be staring at each other, right? So thank you for sharing that. Let's see this Zoom agenda that we made here. We can go on and on. Maybe actually this would be fun to bring in one additional voice into this conversation. And at some point, I do want you, if you have things to share, Andrew, like for sure, I would love for you to be able to share your screen to show where we can find your music. And then later for the studying stuff, if you have something to share, let's make space for that. And what's really nice about this is, whatever doesn't make sense can be cut. So like this little dialogue here, they don't need to know about.
It'll just seem supremely well planned in advance.
Okay, let me share computer sound. This is something I queued up. This is a was a keynote speaker at the STEAM symposium I attended that the College of Ed sent me to. He's a professor at the Teachers College of Columbia University, and he delivered one of the best keynotes I've ever listened to. And I've listened to a good amount, from interior design to food expos. Like, I've listened to a good amount of keynotes, but he was like literally making laps around this humongous conference room telling stories to other people. And he was like standing on chairs. It's just super emphatic, like really creative, you know? So I wanted to play this 1 minute clip.
It is not that the young folks were not able to rise to the expectations of schools. Is that the schools were.
Oops, sorry.
All good.
It is not that the young folks were not able to rise to the expectations of schools. Is that the schools were so simplistic in their methods of delivery, it could not capture the complexity of the ways our kids need it. It's never been that our babies are not able to rise to the high expectations of schools. It is that they find it difficult bending to the unitary, rudimentary methods of the delivery of information of schools. Like, I'm operating on here. Y'all want me to just sit down and take notes? So damn boring. So damn disengaging. Where's the artistic piece? Like, when am I moving my body? When am I reflecting deeply? When am I being creative? When am I drawing connections? Like, they are neuroscientifically operating on such a higher plane that is challenging to divorce myself from my high thinking, to low myself down to just taking notes and listening to you.
I think you have a feeling on why I wanted to share that. I think it resonates to much of what we're talking about. And I love this little user's comment here. Rigor is not giving
It's
students
not that the young folks.
directed work that is incomprehensible to them, which appears to be what many school people think. Rigor is real engagement where the students are doing the heavy lifting, the talking, creating, and leading. I mean, that's literally been the first 30 minutes of what the heck we're talking about in our catch up, right? And I, one thing to empathize with teachers, I think there is something to be said in lecture. Like, there are some benefits of lecture, right? Like, literally they can contextualize a single book and to ideally accelerate our learning for that book. But first and foremost, the book was never really written for my individual learning needs. And my teacher's interpretation and their learning experiences with a book is probably not going to resonate that well with my, demanding learning needs. It might, but In most cases, especially in traditional classrooms, they don't. He does a lot of speaking on what it means to teach, what it means to learn, but I want to give you some space to reflect on what he's saying, Andrew. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this it really I can see why it resonates with you as well, because that's really the this whole philosophy of the learning code that we've spoken about, several times, that there is this infrastructural system where the skills needed to navigate school come very easily to some people and don't come easily at all to other people. And that is not a reflection at all on their intelligence, on their ability to learn, on their curiosity, none of that. It's just how well, like he was talking about, how well they can bend to this method of instruction. And so I think that in my own experiences with teachers and professors that have tried to make things more of the students taking charge, I think it brings up one of the most difficult parts about all this, which again is something that I think the learning code is taking steps towards, is how do we actually make that shift? How do we get from this current educational model where people are given letter grades that I believe were invented to grade meat coming out of meat factories? Like, how do we go from that like pigeonholing system to this universally supportive, uplifting, driving one? And I think that's such a challenging thing to even go about, that I've had a lot of experiences where it seems like it's sort of a student-guided lecture or something, but it ends up feeling kind of trite and like it missed the mark, because it's sort of like maybe we all go through a worksheet and we discover something on our own, but it's not really, it doesn't feel very organic. It feels like it's just another kind of bit of busy work that is making us fill in a bunch of blanks of something that's already very rigid and set in stone, rather than, building intuition, working together, and truly making these discoveries. Because it's almost like, I mean, it really does feel like a fill in the blank for some of these situations I've been in, where it doesn't feel like the instructor is really trusting us to make progress. It feels like the instructor is trying to check the box of making it student guided by just taking out a bunch of words and making us, search for them for 45 minutes. And I think that it sort of devalues the process as a whole if that's the sole approach to allowing students to take the reins, where we're just filling in something that's already been set in stone, and there's still a right and wrong answer and a right and wrong way to do it. And so yeah, I think that I really resonate with the world he's describing. I just think that it brings up a lot of very big questions on how do we actually get there. And maybe this could transition us into the second agenda item a little bit, and sort of your approach to how you've shaped the learning code and what you have discovered along the way about how do we actually take this very big shift where we want to go from system A to system B. How do we actually fill in sort of the middle of that Venn diagram? How do we actually make a smooth gradient between those such that it doesn't feel like everybody's just quitting cold turkey and moving on to something that we're maybe not infrastructurally ready for yet.
Yeah, this is a beautiful question, Andrew. I know there are institutions that have their own system of, or have their own definition of rigor, right? I think Montessori schools, if you've heard of them, like they do a lot more, I don't know, they do creative ways in designing curriculum and engaging their students, for sure. For the learning code, it is, one of the goals is to equip students with the learning skills that professors assume they have, right? Like I empathize with professors because it is true that if I understand coding concepts at a deep level or physics concepts at a deep level, it is less likely that I will build an airplane like Boeing 737 Max, right? It is true for sure. Like, yes, let me understand these things. But even in that quest, I think there's a lot to be said in how much we retain and how much we really, really understand when the metrics of assessment are flawed, right? Like, how much of that stuff is sticky when the term ends and we go on break, and it's a prereq for a class, but we don't really, it's not really a prereq for the class. So that's one thing that comes to mind, and I highlighted that user who commented on rigor. And I just think for many, many students, ones that are in our current system right now, for us to be able to really make some of these theorems, principles, concepts sticky requires that we're doing the heavy lifting. Like that requires self-study. There's no amount of words you tell me, or almost no amount of assignments that you give me, that's going to make these things sticky. Mm-hmm. So the best thing that, you know, I think teachers that we really remember and that we're really grateful for have been creative in that endeavor, right? And it's not always going to work. It's not just because you assign people to be in breakout rooms, it doesn't mean it's like, oh, we're super engaged. Like, we all know this. But I do think it's the willingness to experiment, right? To plan for something, to act, and then reflect, which is fundamentally different than making incremental changes on lecture. And there's one last thing I wanted to say to this, but I wonder if I remember it. But I'm sure you have some responses to what I just said now.
Yeah, I guess while you're thinking of that, I mean, you mentioned stickiness, and that's, you know, I sort of chuckled at that because, like, even somebody who, like, I feel that I've really tried to foster my curiosity, I'm still totally guilty of forgetting very large pieces of classes after I've taken them. And I think there are definitely a few factors to that. I think that, and not to push it all off of myself, because of course a lot of that is of my own doing, not, you know, keeping up with the material. But I think a lot of it is a non-cumulative testing regime definitely contributes to that, where you learn one thing, test it, forget about it, learn the next thing, test it, forget about it. Because then it doesn't necessarily feel like you've really taken a cohesive class so much as you've gone along on a journey and, like, you know, taking a selfie at a couple of little, like, stop posts and then moved along, and then you sort of forget what the whole trip was about. You just know that you have these, like, little snapshots of it. And so I think part of it would be due to that. And part of it might just be due to the fact that the class itself doesn't really align with what I'm trying to do, what I'm interested in. And I think it's perfectly valid to make that delineation. I had a professor my first semester of college who, one of my engineering professors, who talked about how he believes a lot of schools now are too general, and they sort of aren't supportive of specialization. And he said that a lot of schools nowadays try to make everybody good at everything. And he said that it's perfectly healthy and respectable and probably a good idea, realistically speaking, to find the things that you are good at and that you do enjoy and try to become great at those things, rather than trying to become good at everything. And of course, I think a well-rounded education is very important. I think that looking at things that you might not have a passion for is still very valuable. It broadens your perspectives and all that. I just think that there's something to be said for the fact that the classes that I've taken that I've really loved and that have been something that I've continued and continue to think about those things, continue to use those fundamental skills, those are certainly the stickiest classes for me, even if they weren't necessarily taught in the best way, because those are the classes where I would put in the most effort externally to try to make it make sense. Like the things that I've tutored and helped people with, I've tutored some friends in calculus and physics, and those are the sorts of classes where I just was so fascinated by those topics that I would try to think of 10 ways to explain the same thing, like just for fun, like as a creative exercise and just to kind of, you know, help strengthen my own understanding of it. And so I think, again, even if it's not necessarily the best taught class, everybody has different passions, everyone has different skills, and I think that it's very valid to know that about yourself. And like, I would not expect to do fantastically well in a history class without putting in an insane amount of effort, because that's never come easily to me. I've never been very interested in it. And it's just, you know, it's not something that I feel I have anything to prove by trying to master, because it just would be, that would be time and energy that I could focus on things that I find more enriching. And so, you know, I wouldn't expect to remember a ton of details about a history class after taking it. I would hope that I remembered more about a math or a physics class, because, or a music class, right? Because those are things that I do devote a lot of time and energy to, no matter the circumstance. So I would hope that would stick with me a little bit more.
Yeah, I remember what I was going to say earlier, and it relates to what you just said now, which is, you know, I don't think it's realistic for everything that is being presented to us in schools to be sticky. I think that is just not realistic. But I do think it is important to ask the question, how many students are we driving out or keeping out of our academy when we're graduating a subset of these, right? Like, forget about the whole stickiness endeavor. Like, literally, like, how many students are being like dropping out? You know, I have the numbers for that, and the numbers are pretty bleak, right? And you know, yesterday's meeting, I was highlighting this study in 1961. I think they surveyed a bunch of students, and they're saying that they spend, you know, 24 hours studying a week outside of class. And more recently, they're saying it's either 10 or less, 10 hours or less a week. And in my experience, that's probably an overestimate with the amount of, you know, and that's a problem that necessitates innovative solutions. Because if we need to learn the concepts that we need to learn in our courses, it is going to take more than 10 hours a week. There's actually almost no way I'm getting by it unless I've been introduced to those concepts in the class as a preview. Right. So you had asked me, like, how is the learning code going to or trying to address some of these issues at play? And I think the one of the six sub themes is this number three. I think is kind of an important one to this, because what Emden is saying is, you know, we don't even have students engaged because what we're saying is not relevant to their lives. So what are we doing? But from a navigating the system standpoint, like, let's give students the actual skills they need to be able to spend closer or more than 10 hours a week to study, to be, you know, to feel enriched in that process and to really get something out of that process, right? I think many of the students who do end up dropping out or really struggle, like, they've been so traumatized with this idea of grades, right? So intimidated of, you know, getting grades and what grades mean, and they don't have, you know, a good vision for what grades will do for them. So it's no wonder they don't spend the extra time in mastering some of these concepts that the teachers are hoping that we do. But part of the mission of the Learning Code is, you know, to highlight some of the practices, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit earlier, of what students are doing to be able to spend more than 10 hours a week studying, to be able to make these concepts sticky, you know, because ultimately that requires self-study, a ton of self-study. Like, 1 hour of a lecture probably sometimes is 10 hours of work, to be honest, right? And, you know, anecdotally, I am definitely not spending anywhere close the time that I should be spending if I really wanted to understand what my teacher is saying in my CS courses. So I recognize I'm not alone in that.
Yeah, I was certainly guilty of that, especially this semester. And you know, I think this just sorry to interject, but just
No,
to, before I forget this, like, to talk about bridging the gap between current system and ideal sort of future system. You know, I think one of the reasons this semester was so taxing for me is that I was realizing that due to these very less than ideal circumstances, I was kind of no longer practicing what I preached, which was troubling for me. And it was sort of like, I know that I was not alone in this. It's very different. It was very hard for me to do school not at a place of learning. I think that, you know, all of the distractions of being in my own house and just the lack of stimulus of getting to see my peers and go do things, it was very difficult for me to will myself to work, even if I knew exactly what I theoretically should do or needed to do. Just actually doing it was just so challenging, and I found myself kind of falling back on this idea of, like, well, this is not my finest work, but in order for this to not, you know, bleed into my other semesters, I just need to pass these classes or get some certain grade or something. And, like, I hated even thinking like that, because I know that in a perfect world, that would never be the point. Like, it's never the point to just, you know, get some certain grade and just move on and forget everything. But I sort of found myself in that position on more than one occasion this semester, where I was thinking of, like, okay, this is not the best way to do this, and it's not even the way that I know I should be doing it. It's just that right now I kind of can't do anything else. And again, it was like this awful conflict, because we've talked for years about developing good study habits and going beyond the material. And here I found myself so, you know, just unable to get anything done, that I was kind of playing the system more than I was actually getting the most out of my classes, which was awful. But it sort of speaks to how, a lot of people navigate the system already if it comes easily to them. Finding the even in normal times, right? Finding the motivation to go above and beyond and to ask the questions your professor isn't asking, I think is a big barrier for people that are kind of already doing well in school, but might look back, years later and feel like they didn't really learn a whole lot, or they could have gotten more out of it or something. I've talked to my professors currently about this. I started doing research with one last year, and so we've become pretty close. And he was talking about how some of the math and science classes that I'd taken in high school had put me ahead in terms of credits, and so I was free to explore some other options. And he said, keep that momentum alive because other people in your situation, I've seen this happen before. They'll come to college with tons of math and science credits, and then they'll just coast and kind of use that to enable them to skirt around doing more work. And again, even though I'm not the proudest of my work habits this semester, I am still like proud of the course load because I definitely, even though this was a tough semester and I didn't do quite as well, I guess ethically as I wanted to in terms of like really getting the most out of these classes, I did still challenge myself with the material, and it certainly did require lots of outside work. It's just that, unfortunately, this has just been a really brutal time for me to kind of make that on the fly adjustment and think, okay, I'm not actually at school anymore. I don't have a library to go and like just study and do work. I have to figure out how to do this in my own house. And I definitely didn't succeed in that with flying colors, but I think I've learned a lot for next semester at least.
Yeah, habits is so key. I am proud of you each and every single time I talk to you, Andrew. I mean, your willingness to share some time to build out this grassroots movement of reimagining learning, right, for the sake of not only creating significant learning experiences in our classes, but in our life. Like, that's one of the unspoken values of this project, right, is I can use this lens of learning to conversations I have with my engagement with the news, my engagement with my family, my friends, and really to develop this encompassing mindset that, I am far from knowing anything in the world. There's so much I need to learn. And with that, I can put my ego in place and realize whatever anyone's perspective or whatever anyone wants to bring into the conversation, there's value in that because that's their lived experience and that's how they perceive the world. And whether it's even politics, right? Whether it's climate change, politics, coronavirus, you name it, like, gosh, there's the opportunity is endless. But the question I do try to center myself on a weekly basis is how can I use my learning skills to save other people time and energy, right? Because if I were to study all the CS published, I could do that for like 25 lifetimes and I wouldn't even be able to get even scratch the surface, right? So this is where, it gets to my appreciation for you on willing to teach and willing to share because technically, for sure, when you teach, you develop stronger concept images and mental models, but you're also investing time in your local community or in your local class, right? And there's something beautiful about that that I think is more rare, and I wanted to share one more audio clip because I love my audio clips. Is everything okay though when you look outside to the window that way?
Oh yeah, no, sorry. Somebody just drove by. I was checking if
Okay,
there was a delivery or something on.
cool.
We're all good.
Okay, cool. Let me cue this up. Give me one second. Okay, here it is. Okay, so this is Seth. Have you heard this author, Seth Godin, Andrew?
I've not.
Yeah, he has his well, you can read more about him, but this is his podcast, and he's like a professor, and he invests in tech and stuff like this. But I like this little anecdote that his student is about to give. He runs this program called Alt MBA. I'm not going to do an advertisement for him right now, but his student, I think what his student has to say here is really telling, especially in our earlier topic of collaboration and just how important it is. Okay, so I'm going to play.
Possible or probable in today's world to distinguish yourself as an educational institution or as a success seeker at the level of information gathering or information distribution. I mean, this is the information age, and you can get a great book, a great essay, a great idea anywhere, you know, and none of us can do that better than the internet, right? There is no great thought leader who can outthink the internet. Like, we have data. What All MBA gets right is it puts you in a context where you're part of a community that says, yeah, that's good. You got access to ideas, you got access to information, that's awesome, but when are you gonna show up? When are you gonna face that blank page? When are you gonna face the possibilities within you? When are you gonna face those fears? I'm not gonna let you hide. You gotta show up. And that's the hardest part. And it sounds simple, it sounds very commonsensical, but it's the number one reason why we don't write that book. It's the number one reason why we don't ask that question. It's not because we don't know or we don't have the information. We don't have an environment and we don't have a support network that makes it feel like showing up is possible for me. Not just possible for the success stories I see out there, but I can show up.
You could probably get a feeling as to why I shared that clip.
Yeah.
That is, it's so telling, right? Like, I think that's why people struggle in this academy is because if our leaders are constrained in a way so that they can't create those environments for us, it's really up to us to advocate for ourselves and to form study groups and to stay curious in things that may be boring as hell to study, right? Let's be honest. Like, I mean, it's not easy to study the abstract stuff, is oftentimes in STEM, right? And, you know, psychology, history, anthropology can be the same way depending on who you speak to. Right? There are some students who find CS way more fascinating than anthropology, right? So it really depends on who you speak to, but I just think it's, you know, let's take that mantle. And I think you do that every single time you tutor any of your friends, like you are doing that, right? Like, think about that, mm-hmm. right? That's where I did the speech on leadership 2 years back. And I think that word in and of itself requires more comprehensive definition, because when I, you know, traditionally it's like you think about, I don't know, policymakers or lawyers or presidents or governors, but it's like, no, okay, I agree for sure they are in leadership roles and they have a lot of responsibility, but each student has an opportunity to really be a fantastic leader, like just like how you have been for me, right? So that's a big one on collaboration and making learning achievable.
Well, I mean, I must say that I'm flattered and touched whenever you reflect on the influence that I had in that class, because, you know, you talk about willingness to learn, but I mean, just hearing you say how much that experience meant, like that's worth it 1,000 times over. You know, like whenever I am talking to someone about some concept that they might be finding challenging, just kind of knowing that it makes a difference is just such a, it's like giving a really good gift, you know, and like knowing that you kind of did everything right to really make an impact on somebody. That's huge. And I think that maybe people don't feel like they can explain something to someone else, or it's sort of like what the guy was just talking about in the podcast, where you see all of this stuff around you, you see all this content, all this information, and the barrier to actually contribute can be really daunting. And, you know, it has to come from somewhere, right? Everyone has to have faced that at some point. Anyone who's published anything, anyone who's put anything out into the world, and published can be a very loose definition here, but there is always going to be that barrier of, am I qualified to do this thing that I am thinking about? And frankly, I think that everybody can get there. Everybody has something to contribute. Like you mentioned, everyone has, you know, their whole life of experience to draw from. And even if not everybody has a PhD or a credential or anything, like, I don't have any of those things. I feel that I have maybe unique ways to look at the world and to look at problems, and I try to share that with people, and sometimes it makes a difference and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, the times that it does, it's just like that kind of fosters my own passion, not only to learn, but to share. And like, for example, obviously your case, again, very, very touching that has had such a positive impact on you. But I had another experience with one of my housemates freshman year who was so frustrated with one of his math professors. He was taking a calculus class, and he would just rant about this person. And he said that he used to like math, early on, and now it's like this is, he's fallen out of love with it. And I was thinking, oh, no, like this, that's so painful to hear, because having an instructor that leaves a bad taste in your mouth, it's really shocking how profound of a negative effect that can have on somebody. And it was, I can't even describe how good it felt when I was like talking to him about some of these concepts, and like the cogs started to click, and he said like, he actually said like, oh, like math is beautiful again, or something very close to that. And I was like, oh, dude, because that was more than I could have hoped for out of that. I think they were learning about they were learning about logarithm rules, like quotient product rules and that sort of thing. And I had never actually done this myself, but I kind of trusted my fundamentals enough. I said, why don't we just derive these? Because I bet you your professor didn't. And he's like, no, he just gave them to us for us to memorize. And I thought, well, that's no good. And so I just took the very basic definition of a log, where, right, if you have like, log base b of a equals c, like b to the c power equals a. And just from that, we derived all of those rules. And he, like, all of a sudden, the things that he was just getting, that were just being thrown at him, started to actually make sense. And he was able to build them up from these really basic building blocks that, I mean, all math is like that. It's just that not every instructor goes through those motions. And I think one of my biggest issues with some of the classes that I've taken is that it feel, and especially math classes, is that they feel like bags of tricks sometimes, where maybe we learn how to use L'Hopital's rule, and then we get a 20 problem practice set on L'Hopital's rule, and it's like, okay, great, I got 100% on this problem set. Am I an expert now? Not really. I just know that if I see a problem like this, I can use this trick and get this answer. But it doesn't really show the beauty of why you can relate the ratios of derivatives to the ratios of expressions, and that's just something that people don't bother to really explain. But as so I ended up watching like a three blue one brown video on it like years later, and I'm like, wow, I wish somebody had told me that in high school, because that's just so cool. And that kind of fundamental piecing it together, I think, is missing from a lot of classes. Like I remember when I took a differential equations class freshman year, the professor literally said a few times, like, this is just magic. Like, for now, just don't question this. It's just true. And I'm like, I see what you're doing. You have a curriculum to get through. I respect that. I feel for you. You're trying to do a lot of cover a lot of material, but that's just supremely unhelpful to for me trying to build an intuition and build an understanding. To have some any step of the process just removed as if it were magic, or just like take this to be true without question. That's really not, to me anyway, that's not the point of learning something fully. I think having to explain things to other people when I'm tutoring them or helping them out or whatever, it sort of goes back to that Einstein quote, right? Like, if you can't explain it to a 6-year-old, you don't understand it. And if I were to ever say, oh, this is magic, I couldn't leave it there. I would have to come up with some way to make that make sense to that person, because missing a step is just such a frustrating way that, it's like I understand that lack of I understand why having a bad math professor made my friend so disgruntled about math, because if you're just missing all of these crucial steps, you really start to question why you're even there, like what the point of the class is, if not to just, check off some box in your degree sheet and then move on to something that you are more interested in or whatever. And so trying to fill in all of those holes and kind of make the puzzle make sense, rather than just throwing all the pieces at somebody and saying, okay, just do something, and if you get like 70% of the puzzle done, you can move on to the next puzzle. Like, I think that treating classes like that really misses a lot of the richness of the material. So whenever I'm lucky enough to be able to actually work with someone on that and go through these concepts kind of my own way, I always try to leave them with intuition and understanding rather than memorization, which I think is another thing that a lot of my classes have been much more about, like, memorize all these formulas. Doesn't really matter where they come from, and just know which ones to plug in where. And it's like, okay, maybe I could technically do well in the class like that, but I really don't feel like I understand this material. I just think I understand your class, which, those are very different things.
I'd like to begin my response to what you presented just now, Andrew, with perhaps empathizing with teachers first and then empathizing with students. Because your friend's testimony on how an experience with one single teacher shaped, like, strongly left an imprint on their mind of their future in that discipline or subject is in the data, like, 90% of students. Like 90% of students had some negative experience in some field, in some class, and they pretty much, you know, turned away from that field forever, right? And this doesn't even get to the assumptions that sometimes our professors cast upon us that turn into assertions. So that, I guess, is empathizing with the student. Now, to empathize with the teachers, I think let's assume for a moment that each teacher knew how to derive the things that they were presenting from its underlying principles. I already know that's not the case for all teachers, right?
Right.
But let's assume that is the case, and let's assume they do know. But when they are tasked by administrators or by whatever the standard curriculum is to deliver 10 things in, let's say, 1 hour, mm-hmm. you literally almost are like shooting yourself in the foot because mm-hmm. there's not enough time to go deep in 10 things and explain 10 things thoroughly when you've only been given time to explain 3 thoroughly, right? Yeah. So then you get back to this thing which we were touching on earlier. It's like so much of it comes to self-learning, right? Like when you were doing your album build or trying to get that released, I guarantee you can't, there was research upon research upon research, right? It wasn't just like I made a plan and then I did this and then boom, execution. Like you had to dig deeper, right? Right? Like no way. I mean, well, there would have been a way. It's just the end product would have been, you know, not great.
Right.
So I bet even to this day, you're still thinking about perhaps your next release or how to actually, you know, the next stage of what that means in your music portfolio. So that conversation is left out. And when we don't get the chance to turn these ideas presented to us in our classes into our intuition or into our instincts, right? A perfect example of instincts here is the language that we're using to communicate right now with each other is English, right? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if I had to like look up, oh, what did Andrew, like, right. It's not going to work very well, right? So it's all about like the instincts and stickiness, I think, go hand in hand. And once we can get concepts to be sticky, they can then become instincts. And when we can instincts, then we have efficacy and agency. Mm-hmm. And what I am noticing, even in my classmates that do quite well in these courses, they are far away from, you know, turning these concepts into instincts, because that's just, I mean, how can you do that in 10 weeks, right? And it's okay. It's okay. Like, yeah, we're given this time and that's the time that we have to work together. But there's something to be said about the metrics that are measuring this, what we're really getting out of this, these things. And for too many students, they're not getting anything out. In fact, the only thing they're getting out is that they're not smart enough to be a part of these disciplines, or that, I don't know, like one feeling that I had throughout the last semester is like, do I really have the habits that I need to do well in this degree? Right? Mm-hmm. Like most of us know that habits take time to build up, but you got 10 weeks. So do you build habits or do you try to survive?
Yeah. Yeah. That's That is literally like the absolute like slogan of this semester for me. Do you build habits or do you survive? Because I mean, again, for all of my more philosophical ideas about education, I do know that personally, I am not a role model for study habits at all. Like I've certainly been known to procrastinate far more than is healthy. And I think that this semester brought out the ugliest of me in that regard. And again, it was that exact dichotomy. It's like, do I try to reshape myself as a learner, or do I realize that finals are coming up and I just need to survive and then kind of recalibrate? And again, it was like, it was such an uncomfortable position for me to be in, because I was aware of the things that I needed to do. And I was also aware of these bad habits, but there wasn't enough time. And in the circumstance, I found myself in no position to really be my best student. What happened, I guess. But yeah, that so beautifully sums it up. Do I build habits or do I survive? And you know, I think beyond the whole pandemic life, I think that's a really valuable question for students in general. And I think that highlights a lot of the issues with this current system, is that those habits are not taught. They're expected. And if you don't have those habits and you realize that you don't have those habits, and you also realize that your professors aren't very forgiving of not just having those habits instinctively. That's a question that I'm sure almost every student has asked in some way or another. Do I build habits that nobody ever told me how to do? Or do I just do what I know I need to do to kind of work the system and survive the class? And I think that echoes a lot of the sentiment of the learning code as well that we've talked about before, that it's about empowering students with the tools that they need to navigate this and get the most out of their educational system, rather than, you know, teaching necessarily specific concepts, giving the student themselves the tools to kind of do the heavy lifting on their own and get the most out of that process. And so I think, you know, it's a very 2020 slogan, but it also is quite applicable for making the most of this educational system in general. Like, do I navigate or do I innovate? You know, and I think that's such a big question, because it's like, do I do what's easy or what's right? And it can definitely feel like you're a salmon swimming upstream trying to change this whole thing overnight. And we've talked about this. This has been like a theme today of getting from system A to system B. And, you know, you have this kind of stalemate where all the professors are expected to do more in the time they have than they would prefer if they were trying to go deep in everything. And the students are kind of expected to get a certain grade, even though what they ideally would want to do is understand the material and appreciate it. I think this all comes back to that self-studying. You know, if a professor can maybe do one derivation and empower the students with tools to do it, at the end of the day, they can't make the student derive the other nine things. They just can't. I mean, students that want to will, and students that don't want to won't. And I think that connective tissue between the two systems is going to fall to a lot of what the learning code stands for, which is empowering students to do that heavy lifting. You know, if students have to do that heavy lifting to make this transition work, then giving them the tools and the confidence to do that is so important. Because again, if the professor does one or two derivations the right way and says, this is how you do it, I strongly encourage you to try this on these other ones, you know, it's not like everyone is just going to go and do those things right now, because, you know, for any number of reasons, that might just not be the top thing on their schedule right now. But getting them to feel like they really can do it and that there is beauty and value in it, I think is so important to slowly chip away at the current vices and issues of the system, and maybe get us to a place where people are teaching for mastery rather than teaching for grades, and students really feel like they are in control of their learning rather than just kind of catering and bending to this teaching of their instructors. So I think that students are going to have to do the heavy lifting regardless. And so making that as fruitful and worthwhile of a process as possible, I think, is a very noble endeavor to try to pursue.
From a pedagogical standpoint, this is where I love the flipped classroom model. It's definitely not the magic bullet, and there's definitely a lot of discomfort that comes to giving up so much authority to your students and giving up so much freedom to your students. But, you know, when you're talking just now, Andrew, I was really thinking about this idea of getting scammed or buying stuff that is low quality, like knockoff stuff, right? Like, imagine a world where people can have mastery about building like good cups or about building a laptop that can really compete, not in terms of price point, but also quality, right? Mm-hmm. That requires a group of people with skill sets abound, just electrical engineering, computer science, and, you know, and I think in that, you know, in that hypothetical society where more people can have mastery and more people can realize they don't just have to make knockoffs. And, you know, we're not just talking about from a, you know, consumerism standpoint or a commercial standpoint, but like when I don't study a concept thoroughly and I don't try to strive for mastery, I am literally knocking off my own understanding of this concept. Mm-hmm. And you know, what I see in my classes, if I'm lucky enough to have my classmates to have their videos on, is that pain, right? Is that disconnect? It's like they almost know they have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we're in this system that not only doesn't tell us or guide us on how to cultivate these healthy learning habits, but we are literally training unhealthy learning habits, right? Mm-hmm. Course Hero, Chegg, all of these whatever shortcuts to mastery exists in today's world. of technology. So what can we do as students? You know, let's not say for professors, you know, when we get there, you know, we can make real change in our classrooms, but what can we do as students to make that message so clear that it is really the students themselves that suffer the most when they, you know, perhaps take that shortcut, perhaps don't invest a little more energy in thinking about habits? Because that's been me for 27 years of my life, right? So I, you know, one personal goal of mine is just to save people some hurt in that, because it's painful. It's painful to go through so many courses and realize you're not learning anything, right? You are literally the knockoff of a knockoff because you can't even make the knockoff yet.
Well, but I think on the flip side of that, like I remember, so I this was perhaps an unconventional way to do things, but just because of the credits I'd had and because of some advice from some of my advisors, they told me to try taking a graduate applied math class my fall spring semester of freshman year. And I was like, are you sure? And they said, just try it. You know, you can always drop it if you're in over your head. And I had an experience there that I've had in a few other places in my life before in like drastically different times. Like I remember when I walked in to my very first, the first jazz band I ever played in, everybody there seemed like they totally knew what they were doing. And I think I'm sure everyone's had this experience in a class before where it feels like in your paranoid mind, everybody is just doing perfectly. And, you know, one thing that I have learned, and I don't think this is pessimistic, I think this is realistic, is that imposter syndrome is everywhere in life, not just in school. Like in a very real way, people everywhere are kind of faking it until they make it. And I don't think that that's something that should be necessarily considered an awful habit all the time, because like school is preparing people for the real world. And I think that we can have these philosophical ideals of striving for mastery all the time and kind of doing the right thing from a pedagogical standpoint, from an educational standpoint. However, I think that people should also be willing to cut themselves some slack and accept the fact that their professors and their peers are all taking certain approximations to, you know, balance things out. Because also I would say that if you're taking five fairly rigorous classes and you really try to do everything perfectly in one class, there just aren't enough hours in the week to do that in all of your classes. You know, even if things were restructured to an extent, it's always going to be the case that people only have so much time and they do need to sleep and they do need to eat and they do need to exercise. And it's not always possible to cover every single base in every single class. Even if you have fantastic professors, even if the structure is fantastic, everyone at some point in their life will have to make some sacrifices. And like I've had professors tell me point blank, like, I'm kind of winging the lectures this semester. I don't really, you know, I wish I'd had more time to prepare this, whatever. And, you know, it's just one of those funny realities where like, even the best students, the best professors, have to take some approximations. And I guess more than that, true mastery takes time, even if you do everything right. And so a lot of times this like imposter syndrome might not even be the result of trying to game the system. It could literally just be you have not logged enough hours to become a true master of your craft yet. And again, I think that's just a very natural, like, I guess what I'm trying to say more succinctly is that I had thought before college that imposter syndrome was like this voodoo bad thing that you're not supposed to do. And I'm kind of realizing that the thing that people call imposter syndrome is almost an inevitable stage in the growth towards mastery. And it's not something that we should shun. It's something that we should respect and realize that a certain amount of quote unquote impostering while you're trying to find your bearings and really build this intuition, this instinct and get things to properly stick, that never happens overnight, you know? And so like when I'm tutoring some of these things that I've maybe never actually solved the problems before, that might be a very brief form of kind of imposter syndrome where I have to really draw on my instincts and my understanding to try to build new instincts almost on the fly, and try to make it make sense for someone else. And so, you know, I might end up learning along the way, and it's not that I maybe started the tutoring session with a perfect explanation for anything. and I probably don't finish with a perfect explanation, but I mean, like, I might not have started with a great explanation for anything. And so, you know, I sort of become this like instantaneous imposter. I'm like, okay, how do I figure this out? What am I doing here? And it takes a lot of work and a certain amount of time to really be able to speak with authority about something like this. And so I've seen this in professors too. Like you said, you don't believe that every professor could derive every equation they're teaching. I totally agree with that. I think that some really seasoned, really experienced, and really thoughtful professors probably could, but it's not a requirement to do the job, and it's not something that most people could do in a short amount of time. And so, again, it's like, call it what you will, but I think I've just realized these past 2 years that this whole blanket statement of imposter syndrome is kind of just one of the steps that people have to go through to really master their craft. And it's one of the reasons that I have so much respect for true mastery in anything. Like, I was watching this this great Netflix show called The Repair Shop, where people in England like bring these kind of family heirlooms to this like shop of a bunch of different craftspeople that all specialize in something different. So somebody's like a really good clockmaker, somebody's really great with ceramics, somebody restores paintings, and they take these old artifacts and kind of give them a new life. And I remember somebody brought in like it was for making butter, like a butter churn. And it was like a little wooden barrel. And they found like one of the last remaining barrel experts in England. And it was like such a like specific skill. But just watching him work, I'm like, wow. I mean, this is clearly somebody who has developed incredible instincts, incredible intuition for every little thing he's doing. Even though it's like way out from sort of the modern gamut of skills and things that people typically learn. Just watching him work with that level of, it was like as easy as breathing for him. And I just think like, that is what everyone hopes to achieve at some point. But that takes so much time. Even if you're doing all the right things, you just have to kind of trust yourself, trust the process, and trust that if you follow that passion for years, you will get there. Like, I think about my intuitions for physics and math now versus in high school, and even over these past couple of years, using them in new ways, teaching them to different people, they've gotten so much stronger. And I feel that they've kind of bled into my understanding of the world, just being able to ground myself more in these practices and get a little bit closer to mastery through these new experiences. It's just been so valuable for me to put that all in perspective and like recognize that even if I can't do everything perfectly or do everything the way I want to, I am still making progress from where I was. And even through my mistakes and my bad habits, I'm learning what I need to do to be a better student these next 2 years of undergraduate and, you know, whatever might come after. So again, I don't think that it's productive for anybody to kind of beat themselves up for what they might be doing wrong. I think that some, you know, nobody's perfect, and some amount of approximation is inevitable in the process. It's just important to be cognizant of what you're doing and what you could maybe improve incrementally over the next, you know, next semester, next quarter, whatever, to try to not necessarily become a master right away by some big lifestyle change, but just get yourself closer and nudge yourself in the right direction and continue to build off of good habits rather than, you know, saying, oh, like, I shouldn't even be here. What am I doing? I'm doing all this stuff wrong. Like, do I have what it takes? What's the point? Trying to eliminate those big nagging questions and come up with incremental steps to better yourself, not massively overnight, but incrementally over a month or 2 months or whatever, is just such a valuable thing that I've tried to carry with me, especially after this very less than ideal semester. You know, trying to think constructively about such a taxing experience has been a really important challenge for me to try to tackle.
Wow, I'm glad I captured that response, Andrew. You wrote a blog post there with your words. No, serious, right? I was having a very fun time making the connection of imposter syndrome to habits to deliberate practice, because this mic probably can't pick it up. My neighbor has a batting cage and I hear him, he's been hitting balls. I don't know if he can pick it up, but he's been hitting baseballs over the last, I don't know, half hour. So I'm hearing it, you know, being hit. Mm-hmm. And there's something to be said about practice, right? Because as we know, not all experience is good experience, right? Like, I don't know how he's hitting the baseball, but sure, repetitions are good, and repetitions in woodworking and producing music, in you know, understanding a theorem or deriving a theorem, requires repetition, no doubt in my mind. But if the reps are done without consciousness of what it means to do good reps, if reps are done without consciousness to have an end goal of perhaps mastery, right? Perhaps lifelong learning, or perhaps changing, right? Changing in not only behaviors, but our beliefs, our attitudes, and ultimately the knowledge that we embody, then there could be a lot of harmful experiences, even though we're doing that work, right? And I think my most recent blog post on lying, hiding, and faking is directly related to imposter syndrome and directly related to why are there so many knockoff stuff, right? Why are we, it's like a race to the bottom, right? As far as price points goes, but no one likes to buy things for a cheap price that end up breaking in a week, right? Mm-hmm. Like no one. So there's a lot to be said there, but I think this is a good time to transition to maybe one last idea that I had in my mind, which is if you have anything to share in terms of visual stuff, Andrew, I think for sure you should show your album and where we can find more information on that. And maybe when you're doing that, you can speak for a minute about, you know, just a minute about why people might listen to your album, besides the fact that they should just listen to it anyway because you're a dope ass dude. But so do that, and then if there's anything in terms of like if there's any notes you'd like to share that you took over the last semester or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. I think this could be the last thing, and then we'll kind of end it there for this one.
Yeah, for sure. So I don't really have any great visuals, but I can kind of talk about how I took notes and like what's been helpful for me in the past, maybe at the end. But yeah, for the album, definitely I could just play one of the shorter songs if that's all right.
Yeah, that's definitely all right. That's more than all right. If you share your screen, Andrew, or there's a checkbox at the bottom.
Yeah, for sure. Sound?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, so so first of all, this is the little cover art. I don't know if I can enlarge that at all.
But so it's, cool.
Yeah, a good friend of mine took that picture back on campus, and I photoshopped it and posterized it to make it, you know, look almost like an airbrush painting or something. But yeah, this song called Daffodil was by far my favorite to record. You know, again, for different songs, we kind of broke up the workflow in different ways. So for the most part, I produced the songs, which basically means I recorded all the parts, whether it was parts that I would sing or like instruments that I would play through my keyboard or whatever. And then I would send all of those sound files over to Zach, and he would do the mixing. So he would balance everything, you know, adjust the levels, equalize, you know, kind of manipulate the frequency bands of everything to make everything gel together really nicely. And that was sort of how we did it. And for a few of them, we switched things up. For some of the songs, I would just like record a melody and give that to Zach, and he would do all of the instrumental arrangements and everything else. So he would do all the production. And for some of them, you know, I would do the mixing instead of him. So we tried to shuffle it around for a few of them just to make sure that we all got as much out of it as we could. But this is one of the ones where I did all the production. So I actually wrote this song pretty recently too. I think I wrote it over the summer. And it was just so much fun for me to sing. And it seems to be one of the crowd favorites, I guess. Like people were texting me afterwards like, oh man, Daffodil's so much fun. And, you know, it really was just an amazing experience for me to piece it together. And I think that it was one of those things, and this is definitely something that I keep trying to tie this back to academics somehow. You know, I think that there's always value in validating your ideas all the time, and then deciding later which ones are the most helpful to you or not. And so, you know, you're talking about keeping track of your questions in a lecture, right? If you have 50 to 100 questions, those are all valid questions, whatever they are. You might be able to answer some of them yourself pretty easily. Retroactively, you're looking back and you're like, oh, I think I actually understand that. You know, maybe these 20 or 30 questions out of the 100, I think I kind of get it now. And, you know, some of them you might need to look something up or ask a friend or ask your professor or what have you. But I think there's always value in getting as many ideas out as you can, and then maybe thinking about it more categorically once you've given yourself some space. And so this was definitely an example of that, where I threw a lot of ideas, you know, at this, and not all of them stuck. My initial demos sound very little like the final product, but that was sort of the beauty of it, was just giving myself the freedom to try lots of different things And so there are things in this song that I've never done before. And that was really just a product of letting myself be free, trusting that all of my ideas were worth something. Whether or not they actually made the cut or not was a different story. But I think that this, going back to that clip from the podcast you showed me, where the guy was saying there's so much information out there, but you always, you have to take this leap of faith to actually contribute to it. And I was also mentioning before, people might not feel qualified to explain something to someone else. And I think there really is a lot of self-trust that has to happen and has to be present for people to take those leaps of faith and think, okay, I know I'm not a professor, but I think I can help. And trusting themselves to take that leap, because you can, beautiful things can happen when somebody just shares their ideas. And even if you might not think they're worth anything, or you might think that everybody already knows it, that's never a guarantee. Some of the things that it might be the first intuitive idea that I have, it might be the last one that somebody else has, and vice versa. They might think of a way to explain something that would take me ages to come up with if I ever came up with it. And so just being willing to try things and to share is, I mean, no matter what you're doing, right? Whether you're producing a song or taking a class or I mean, literally anything else in this world, people will have ideas that they might not really consider because they might think, oh, that's nothing. Oh, that's not good. Yeah, I think there's always value in just letting another pair of ears take a listen to what you're thinking, and maybe say, hey, you know what? Let's see where this could go, rather than just scrapping it right away. Because again, you never know. Like, I've heard authors talk about this a lot too, where maybe 1 in 20 book ideas actually becomes a book. But if they were restrictive with their ideas and they never tried anything, they probably wouldn't write anything at all. You have to cycle through these ideas that don't make it to find ones that do, and just trust that everything is worth something, even if it's maybe not exactly what you're looking for. So without further ado, this is Daffodil.
I love the way you look at me, like I'm the only thing in the whole wide world that you see. You and I, we got nothing but time to spend. So you put your head on my shoulder till I don't know where I start and where you end. Yeah. I wouldn't have it any other way. Watching clouds roll by with you all day. I know that everything will be okay. You always know what to say. You're the merriment to my laughter. You're the steady breeze to my sail. You're the happily ever after to my fairy tale. You're the water and you're the sunlight to my tree. You're the daffodil to my bumblebee. I love the way you hold me tight. As every day turns into every night. I wouldn't have it any other way. Watching clouds roll by with you all day. I know that everything will be okay. You always know what to say. You're the merriment to my laughter. You're the steady breeze to my sail. You're the happily ever after to my fairy tale. You're the water and you're the sunlight to my tree. You're the daffodil to my bumblebee. To my bumblebee. To my bumble, to my bumble. You're the daffodil to my bumblebee.
To my bumble, to my bumble.
You're the daffodil to my bumblebee. You're the reason for my elation. You're the breather when I get tense. You're the every explanation when I don't make sense. You're the tide, the waves, and the sunset to my sea. You're the daffodil to my bumblebee.
To my bumble, to my bumble, to my bumblebee.
You're
So legit, man. That's so inspiring to hear.
But yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, like, I certainly, whenever I start writing a song, I don't want to call it self-doubt so much, because I think that has a very negative connotation, but I've certainly, I'll listen to something in the early stages and just think, like, how am I going to do this? And it takes sometimes just, like, staring at my screen and, like, staring at my keyboard and thinking, like, what does this need? And it's such a slow process until it isn't, you know what I mean? Like, it can take so long to get something to click. And then there's a point, you know, if it's a song that I really end up liking, where I just start, like, grooving out to it. I'm like, okay, I think this has something now. And I sort of inspired to take it to the next level. So, like, the very first choruses, when I was starting writing it, I'm like, I don't know. It has some good bones, I guess, but I really don't see what to do with this. And it just took hours and hours and hours of trying different things and, like, trusting myself to explore, even if it wasn't, you know, ever going to make the final cut. I just had to try lots of things until it clicked, because very rarely does everything come together super instinctively. That's happened for maybe one or two songs, but again, by far the exception to the rule. I've written a lot more than one or two songs, and it's not common for things to just all slot into place magically. So yeah, I mean, I think I love that in particular, that song in particular, because I just tried so many things that were so different from my normal wheelhouse, and just trusting myself to make those kind of personal innovations, I guess you could say, is, you know, it was really just like a self-fueling journey after a certain point. Once I started to appreciate it and realize that it was really going somewhere, I was awake at like 1 a.m. recording vocals, and just like this huge smile on my face, 'cause I'm like, oh, this is so much fun. Like, I'm finally like reaping the rewards of that initial self-trust of like, okay, this doesn't sound like anything yet, but there is a way to do this, and it's going to take time, but you will figure it out. And like, once it started to fall into place, I'm like, okay, now I can just groove to this thing.
You know, what's crazy is what you just described there, Andrew, is how I've been feeling with this book, and it's just a computer science book, right? Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's what learning requires, for you to sit in that discomfort and you to realize like, there is light at the end of the tunnel in understanding something or producing something and generating something. And it's just, you know, it's a slow burn.
Well, and it's one of the reasons that I love music and engineering. It's a lot of the same roots, even if it doesn't externally seem like they're that related. I've always been enthralled by the idea of creating something from nothing. And so, you know, in engineering, like, I guess my predecessor to engineering right now has been woodworking, which I've done like since middle school, and I loved that idea of like,
have you featured that
in the next
talk.
Let's for sure.
But
I mean, that was something where I fell in love with this process of like, okay, you have something that you need in your life, some physical thing, you know, you could go buy it, or you could analyze the problem, analyze the situation, design something, figure out a strategy for actually manufacturing it, how you're going to turn this design into something that will actually serve its purpose, and then building the thing. And, you know, like for years, I made all the Christmas presents I gave to people, because it was just like such a fun new dimension to add to this whole thing of like thinking of what somebody would really enjoy, and then thinking of how I could actually physically create something where there was nothing before. And it's the same exact thing for songwriting. Like, I'll go through some experience, I'll have something that inspires me in some way, and I really feel like there's no other way that I can fully express that with words alone, or even with music alone. It sort of needs this blend of both, and so just like looking, this might sound kind of narcissistic out of context, but like looking back on the album now and realizing like that was nothing in May or whatever, like that's just such a surreal feeling for me that I took this product of all these things that have happened to me the past 4 years, and obviously with lots of collaboration, like turned them into this thing, this physical product that is now like a snapshot of my life this year. Like, that's just such a crazy thing for me to think about, that, you know, I'm kind of following in the footsteps of anyone who's ever released any music before. It's a snapshot of where they were, and it kind of archives this place in their life in a way that, you know, few other things can do quite the same way. And so, yeah, I mean, just the creative process and the idea of making something out of nothing is something that's always fascinated me. And so, Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that you would find similar things in a computer science book. Like that doesn't sound hard to believe at all for me, because that's exactly this philosophy that I personally really believe in for uniting my seemingly disparate passions together through these common roots. So yeah, I think that's awesome that songwriting and CS can kind of go hand in hand in the same way.
Big time, big time. Let's end this one here, Andrew.
Sure.
I can talk to you for another hour if I wanted to, but yeah, next time, I would love to hear you highlight some of your woodworking and see images, or actually see the objects that you can hold into your
Yeah,
hand.
for sure.
And then I'm thinking also next time, maybe we can take a deeper dive in what both of us are doing to succeed academically, and maybe we can prepare some visuals to support that stuff.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much again for giving me the opportunity to talk about all this. It's been great to catch up with you. It's been far too long. So yeah, this is really fun.
I know, I'm glad we documented it. I already know that I'm going to rewatch it. But yeah, this is a habit in and of itself, right? It's
Yeah.
kind of a hustle, but what is a hustle besides a string of continual habits that
Yeah.
you build up?
Right.
So thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank
And
you.
I can't wait to revisit what we said here, because I think there's a lot of fruitful stuff in terms of reimagining learning and reimagining the purpose of education.
Yeah, for sure. All right, thanks so much, man. Take
All right,
care.
bud. See you next time.
Bye.